Welcome back to the Catch Bits Show, everyone. This is one of your co-hosts, Mike Moran. I'm joined by our usual co-host, Neil Punchard. Hi there, Neil.
Mike, good afternoon from sunny, well, not sunny, almost sunny Minnesota.
Well, that's great because it's sunny here in Arizona. Super good. Sunny. We just had, last night, we had the Falcon 9 rocket that I guess it's launched in California these days.
Wow.
And you can see it fly over from my front porch. So we all sat out there and watched that. It's quite amazing. You can just see like the spray coming off of it as it pierces the sky or whatever stratosphere it's in. Pretty fascinating.
Do you have to wear special Falcon glasses like for the solar eclipse or can you?
What is that all about? I'm so tired of hearing about the solar eclipse. I'm going to go out there next week. I'm going to stare straight at the sun. So whatever the crowd does, I'm going to do the opposite. Anyway, speaking of long distances, we have a third co-host tonight, all the way from Sheffield, England, Stephen Cocker. Hi there, Stephen.
Hello. You all right?
It's evening there.
It is, yeah.
Thanks for joining.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
A proper cutler on tonight. Not just some knife maker in his garage, but a properly trained cutler. We're super excited to have you on here, and we've been wanting to do this for a while. So glad you could join.
Thank you.
And I said Sheffield. Do you live in Sheffield in town?
Yeah, I live in Sheffield. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Did you grow up there?
I've always lived in Sheffield. Yeah, all my family's from Sheffield. Born and bred in Sheffield.
Boom. There we go.
Stephen, with my love of Sheffield Knives, I can't tell you how excited I am when Mike told me that he was going to get you on and we're going to talk about Sheffield Knives because I might seem calm and relaxed, but I'm jumping inside.
Yeah, if you know Neil, he's just dying right now.
Oh, geez,
yes. In fact, we've already had show and tell before the show started and Neil peppering Stephen with tons of questions. And I actually just want Stephen on to answer that age-old questions. Rogers or Wostenholm? I say Wostenholm.
I like
maybe
both.
Rag.
Yeah. Yeah. I like
put
it.
You in a tough spot, huh?
Yeah. Well, my heart always lies with Joseph Elliott.
Oh.
Because that's where my dad used to have a workshop.
Okay. Well, hold on a second. Your dad had a workshop.
Yeah. Well, my dad was a French polisher, but all his past family... my granddad, my great granddad, all used to work at Joseph Rogers. So they've all worked in this. Yeah, they've all worked in this trade.
Stephen, can you tell our audience what the French polisher does?
A French polisher restores furniture. So antique, they get old like furniture. My dad used to strip it down and bring it back to its original like glory. Hmm. But he rented a workshop at the Sylvester Works of Joseph Elliott's. And that's where my love of knife making began. We like skipped a generation because obviously all my dad's side of the family and my mum's were all in this trade. And then my dad changed slightly, went down the woodworking route, and then I brought it back as in knife making.
Did your dad do anything with knives? Did he do any restoration of cutlery?
He's done various things. Yeah, he used to do a lot for silversmiths. So with the trolleys where they had like big silver domes on, where they used to have the meat on going into fancy restaurants, my dad used to restore all those.
Oh my gosh, trolleys. I'm thinking like a street train, but you're talking about a little cart you push around the
restaurant.
A
mahogany frame trolley.
Well, Neil and I aren't that fan. I don't think I've ever been in a joint like that.
Yeah.
Oh. I don't know if they have those at McDonald's here in America or not.
Yeah, they had all these like fancy restaurants in London where they used to have like the a big silver dome, and my dad used to restore all the woodwork on it.
Wow, that is fascinating! And restore it to its former glory, you said.
Yeah.
you don't hear anybody saying that about modern furniture these days, do you?
No.
You don't use the word glory behind that. Interesting. Yeah. So your grandfather was a cutler?
Yeah. Well, on my dad's side, he used to make. Shears, so they used to work on big drop stamps, and then I had aunts and uncles who were grinders. They both worked at my auntie and uncle. Well, my dad's auntie and uncle used to work at Joseph Rogers, and he was a grinder, and she was a buffer.
No kin. I think about those the scissors guys, the old Ken Holly videos that are out there of some of those guys.
Yeah. Well, because I was my dad's, my auntie and uncle, they started at Rogers back in the like 1930s. And they were just working like old school and like researching that. It was fascinating.
Wow. Now, does cutlery go back any further in your family that you know of?
Yeah, my mum's family, they were silversmiths. They used to work at James Dixon's. They've had Walker and Hall. Even like, back on my dad's side, they were all hand grinders and obviously pocket knife makers. So we've always been in this trade.
So when you were young, Stephen, would you help out your dad in the shop there? Or
yeah, I used to help my dad.
What did you do?
Yeah, every school holidays or like after school, used to go down to my dad on Sylvester Street and just taken back by it all. I was just so interested in watching the old guys make knives.
And did you know at an early age that you were wanting to do that?
Yeah, from 8 year old, I just had, there was just something that clicked because obviously my dad were in this old workshop. I just found it fascinating. And from 8 year old, I wanted to make knives. I don't know what it was, and just loved it. So, because obviously there were still old cutlers down at Sylvester Works. They give me some old parts, and my dad used to know them all because he used to do work for them, and they were like all good friends. And so I just had some old parts, and we just used to make them up.
It didn't have anything to do with those old guys sneaking you cigarettes and letting you drink off their beers or anything like that? It was just the nostalgia of it all.
Just nostalgic, yeah. Because I was just in like an old Victorian works. It was just because there are only a few people there, to just the history in that, I just felt something when I was there, it was just so interesting. I just wanted to like think, we're losing it from Sheffield, and I wanted to be the one who like restored it, carried it on. Because I saw like these old guys who were like coming to retirement age, they used to say, oh, you don't do this as a job. But I found now I want to protect it.
Good.
Yeah.
You spent a fair amount of time with Stan Shaw, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. Yeah, I knew Stan very well. He used to know my dad, yeah. Huh. My dad and him were friends, so obviously I just picked up from that. A lovely bloke.
I was over in Sheffield, I think about 8 years ago now, and I was visiting a good friend of mine, Jack Black, who took me to Stan's shop, but unfortunately, Stan wasn't feeling well that day, and I was only there for 2 days in Sheffield, 2.5 days, and so I got to see his shop, which was wonderful, but I always regret not meeting him in person and hearing so many stories about Stan, and you know, what a character, and what a talk about dedicated, holy cow, I mean, the guy was in his workshop in his 90s making knives, and what an inspiration, I would think, for someone like you to see this guy who was kept the candle burning to pass on to you.
Yeah. Well, he used to, because when I left school, I went to work at Iberson's, which was part of Eggington's at the time. I worked across the road from Stan. So every dinner time I was in his workshop, we'd be chatting away, have dinner together. We'd become like good friends. And a guy who I used to work with at Iberson's, he was trained up by Stan, originally at John Watts and then at Iberson's.
Huh. Wow, John Watts. Who was that?
Oh, a guy called Peter King. He was a really good bloke. Really, he was really good at his job.
What do we need to know about Stan? Give us one Stan Shaw story. He's beloved the world over.
Yeah, well, one thing, he didn't know, I've got it here. In the old Iberson catalogue, he didn't know that he was star at front page.
Oh yeah.
So that's from about 1972, I think that one, that Iberson catalogue. And the Stan didn't even know that they'd used him as front page, picture on the front page.
Oh, that's now that catalog's going to be.
Yeah.
Neil, we got gobble up any remaining catalogs of that.
I don't have that catalog. Oh, yeah. Man. That
it's brilliant.
Great.
It's
a young Stan Shaw with the 70s hair.
Yeah. Using a parser.
Yeah.
Using the parser. You got to have Stan Shaw using a parser, or it's not a picture of a cutler.
And obviously, with it being George Iberson's, it's so connected with Stan.
Did you do any collaboration work with Stan yourself? Did you do anything where you combined your talents both on a knife or played around on something?
I wish I had. I just used to spend hours in his workshop watching him. He used to show me what he was working on. I used to obviously show such a passion because he had made a knife. And because I worked with Peter, who used to work with Stan, he says, oh, pop over to Iberson's and show it to him. So I'd like run across the road and go and show it Peter, who used to work with.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, would Stan, when you guys were hanging out and talking, like, you know, I talk with a lot of knife makers throughout the day, almost every day, which is why I never get anything done. And the one thing that's common amongst all knife makers, in my experience, is if we're talking to each other, we're working. Because you just can't stop making knives or you barely make any money as it is. Would Stan sit there and just chat with you, or was he like hammering on some pins and running the file?
Yeah, sometimes it would sit and we'd just chat away. Or many times I preferred it when he carried on working so I could just watch him. Like picking his brains.
Yeah.
When he says, well, I'll have my dinner as well, it was like, no, you carry on for a bit. I'll not disturb you.
Yeah. Don't mind me with my notepad here.
Yeah.
What is there a takeaway that you, was there a technique or something that you learned from him?
Well, I used to take my, at the time when my dad bought me a camera, because I'm interested in history as well. So used to take it down to stands and I'd say, oh, do you mind if I like film to document? He says, no, help yourself. So I used to be like filming him as well. So I used to watch him working and record bits what he were doing so that I could go back and like think, oh, I can rewatch that, see how he used to do it. And we built up like a bond so I could like just, in a way, like learning from him.
Wow.
You were excellent.
That's neat. We've got there's some footage of Stan out there that's in a private collection, in Stephen's private collection.
Yeah. I'll have to put it on YouTube.
Yeah.
So Stephen, did you have a job before you went full-time into knife making? Were you doing something else? To make a living, or did you jump right into knife making?
No, when I was still at school, I had a Saturday job working with Trevor Ablett making pocket knives.
Yeah, okay. He's a famous cutler, yeah.
Because he was another friend of my dad's, because he used to work at the Sylvester Works. And I remember Trevor says, you come and work with me if you want. He says, but you need to ask your dad permission. He says, because I'm not insured. So he says, if you ever have an accident, he says, I can't. And he says, no, that's fine. So my dad says, no, you can go and work with Trevor. So I used to work with Trevor on a Saturday and Sunday. And then during the school holidays, I used to do like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, just helping him out with like assembling, polishing, doing all the techniques. And then when I did get to leaving school, that's when I went straight to Iberson's to work. So I've never had any other job. This is all I've ever done.
And what age did you start working with Trevor?
I was about 14.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But before then, I used to help out two other guys who were, one was a polisher, he used to work at Dixon's, another guy, Frank Carr, he was a knife maker. I used to be pottering about making knives with him.
My understanding is Trevor's one of the last of the old guard, and he was trained with the old techniques.
Yeah, Trevor was, yeah. And when I used to work with Trevor, he always used to say to me, he says, he always had like old tools on his bench. And one thing he says, I've got one tool, Stephen. He says, when I retire, he says, you can have it. We're true to his word. It was only like a simple dotting tool. And a guy he worked with give it to him and he'd got it off this other guy. And when he retired, I used to still go over to his house and see him when he were poorly. And when he passed away, his wife gave it me. She says, oh, Trevor wants you to have this. And I've still got it.
Oh, wow.
And what was the tool?
I'll show you. I've got it here. Like a dotting tool. So you put your lining on. You set it to where you need to. Lock it in your vise.
Yeah.
And then you tap where the little pins are. And it's exactly where the spring, like where you need to drill it for the spring.
Right.
And that would one of like Trevor's sacred tools.
Ah.
Wow. The thing we're looking at is a jig of some sorts, and it is old.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he always says, when I retire, he says, you can have it. And I never thought anything about it until obviously, sadly, he passed away, and his wife says, "Here, Stephen, Trevor's got some tools for you." So I still use that today in my workshop.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah.
That is very neat.
Yeah.
To think he saved that for you certainly had some importance. It certainly meant that it was maybe one of his favorite tools or go-to tools. And you look at it and you think, it doesn't look like much, but if somebody says, I want you to have this, to me, that means a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I know Trevor always, he had it always on his bench and he always used it. And he said to me, I was only young, he says, when I retire, he says, you can have this. And it was his go-to tool. And obviously now I've got it.
Wow.
I still use it.
That's fascinating. I mean, that is a tool. I've seen a picture of it. It's in some cutlery book somewhere I have. But if you put it on my workbench, I wouldn't be able to use it. These are skills that are lost almost to history. Maybe, maybe just you.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's a neat old tool. I mean, and now I think I'd be lost without it. I've got used to using it, and and how it performs, like when you dot your linings to then drill them, it's just perfect.
Wow. Any idea how old that thing is? Late 1800s?
Possibly, yeah. And when you think the amount of knives that have been obviously made using it, it's a fascinating tool.
Stephen, are there any other young fellows like you out there making knives, cutlers? Do you know of any other guys that are something around your age? Is there any kind of a resurgence?
Yeah, there's a few people who are. I mean, at Eggington's, we've got a few who I'm trading up to try and to keep the tradition going.
Huh.
We've got a few, and we've even got, I've trained my wife up. She works with me at Eggington's.
How do I train my wife up? Is there like a course for that?
Well, what I said, I mean, my wife never decided she wanted to do this as a job. She just, obviously, as the time came on, she was offered a job at work and she took it and she's worked her way up. And now she's supervisor at work. she's become good at her job.
Oh, wow. Wait, she's your boss at home and at work?
I was just going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
How convenient for her.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's back up. Let's talk about Eggington's for a minute.
Yeah.
Can you give us the Wikipedia entry of how Eggington's got started and what it's become today so we can understand better what it's done?
Yeah, well, Eggington's, they were sharpening steels. That's what their main business was, sharpening steels. And then about 1982, they were going to buy a company called Donnelly's, which made forks in Sheffield. And the owner says, because Donnelly's owned Ibbotson's, and Ibbotson's had gone into receiverships, and the owner, he turned around and says, oh, what's that firm as well, what you've got? He says, oh, that's Ibbotson's. So we offered, he says, oh, I'll buy that as well to preserve it. So he bought Ibbotson's on the condition that everyone who worked at Ibbotson's would come and work for him, which they did.
Wow, so you don't hear that very often.
No, yeah. So he saved, in a way, he did it to save, obviously, Sheffield, we were losing stuff at the time, like these old names. So he bought it, took it on, and then eventually Joseph Rogers and Wusternholmes was closing, receivers had come in, and he needed a place for Ibbotson's to move into. So he jumped in and thought, well, I'll take that over to protect it. To save it for these firms have been in Sheffield for that long, we didn't want to lose them. So he then bought them as well, but on the condition that everyone who worked there would carry on working.
You say he, Stephen, is there one fellow then that owns Eggington's and is it a family member? I know Eggington's goes back to at least the late 1800s, early 1900s, don't they?
Yes, it's still owned by the same family.
It is? Okay.
Yes, yeah. And now it's his son who's running it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So even during the tough times, especially in the 80s, I mean, I think Wollstone, the combined company of Wollstone-Holm and Rogers, I think, was dissolved around 83.
Yeah.
And so Eggington's was still doing okay financially. They were still, because so many companies were falling like crazy.
They were.
Yeah. How was it that Eggington survived? What kept them alive? What was their marketing strategy, or what did they do that kept them afloat?
I think they were just being run correctly. They were
okay.
He knew the market. He was running it right, and then obviously these opportunities come around, and he didn't want to see them be lost in Sheffield. Yep. So he took a risk and took them and saved them.
So who's making the knives now that are stamped Woolston Home and Rogers for Eggington?
Well, that's myself, and I have obviously my wife, and we have about another five people
who
I'm training up.
Right. Huh.
Yeah. But when I started, we did have a lot of the old people who were there, but obviously they've now retired.
Right.
It's just like I've worked my way up, and now I'm trying to train the next generation.
What percentage of time do you allot to Eggingtons versus your own personal knives?
Well, I work full time for Eggingtons.
Okay.
So I'm doing like 39 hours a week. And then on my own work, when I come home, I work the evenings doing my own stuff.
Okay, so you don't sleep then, basically.
No. Yeah. And sometimes it kids, feels that right? way.
Yeah.
I've got kids as well, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So, yeah, I mean, I'm just like you, Stephen. I make exhibition pieces just weekends, you know, 2 in the morning and Saturday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like that. I don't want to watch telly, so I think I'll go and do a few hours making. I find a picture in an old pattern book, and I think, I want to recreate that.
Yeah.
Then oh, you're nuts.
Just go in the workshop.
You're a sick man.
Yeah.
That's great.
How do you draw up your, when you see a picture in a book, then do you take some kind of a CAD drawing, or how do you dimension off that knife to make it? Because I know Mike's talked about that a lot over the time of how do you take a picture and convert that to a knife that you can build dimensions off of?
Well, a lot of time I have some of the pattern books which I have.
Of course, he's got the pattern books.
Yeah.
I've got the original drawings.
We're looking for those, by the way.
Yeah. I've got the original drawings, which are in the books. So
right.
I normally find it has a description, or I have the drawing of it, and I'll trace it round and then just cut every piece out by hand from it.
Wow.
Do you have a favorite pattern book to work from?
I do. I've got a Lockwood Brothers one, and it's a brilliant book. It's got some really detailed, some absolutely amazing patterns in.
The artwork, the patterns themselves are art.
Oh, they're brilliant. Yeah, and they're so well. Yeah. And to think somebody's drawn them with a quill pen.
I know.
They're so detailed, and they're lovely. They're really interesting. I mean, even just sat reading it, the handwriting, the descriptions, the picture of the knife, it's stunning. I spend more time reading them than what I think like we're making. I just love to go through them.
It is. It's fun to see. I'm fortunate to have some pattern books, and it's fun to see not only, like you said, Stephen, the drawings are amazing. I mean, they were true artists who drew these things, but it's also fun to see all the little notes and the arrows and all the little detailed descriptions. And you can see you can almost see them thinking as they're drawing and what implements, what tools, what blades are going to have on there.
Yeah.
And to see it all hand done, you can almost, I don't know, it's amazing.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Even to the pickers and the tweezers and the scissors, they're all drawn and they're stunning, and they're all drawn to like the same size. So I just copy it from obviously the pattern book.
Right.
Have you ever found those? So I don't have the luxury of working from pattern books, but I've taken old catalogs and, you know, original catalogs and run them through the copy machine or scan them into the computer and start drawing around them. But then I start working it in the drawing program and it doesn't work. Like the knife just does not work. There's no geometry in the world that'll make that knife work. And then you realize this knife was probably never made by this company because it doesn't work in the catalog to begin with. Have you ever come across that in the pattern books, or are they all legit?
They all seem legit, these what I've got. It's I know what you mean by somewhere you think, oh, how would that work, and it doesn't like match up. But luckily with these the pattern books, a lot of the time that the components are all drawn out. So for like somewhere they've meant to got seven springs in, and it, you see which blade goes to which. So just use that.
You know, something I've noticed, Mike, is that some of these pattern books or some of these real early catalogs, I firmly believe that these guys were basically robbing pictures, robbing ideas from other cutlery companies. And robbing is kind of a harsh term. They were borrowing. So they saw a pattern that someone else did, and they drew it in their pattern book. And it wasn't necessarily their pattern, but I've seen that several times over and over, where you can see that they're taking liberties with someone. Some guy said, "Hey, that's a great idea. Let's make our version of that knife." So I think some of these might have been more conceptual than dimensional.
Yeah, a lot of the time, I know at Joseph Rogers, the cutler's shop, they used to lock the door. So where the craftsmen worked, obviously nobody could go in. The only thing that ever come out was finished knives, because the cutlers didn't want anyone else seeing their techniques, their methods. So they used to lock the door. So it was just them in there making these knives.
Wow, that sounds like Bill Howard from GEC.
Yeah, Bill, you've been dishing.
There's a secret room that nobody goes in.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, that's like it always seems to be the well-guarded secret in American cutlery history is the jigging machines that they made to jig bone. That always seems to be the most well-guarded secret.
Yeah, like nobody wants, you're not allowed to know.
Yeah, or the dyeing processes, that type of thing. Those always seem to be the last secrets to be dispelled.
Yeah.
I'm curious, did Trevor or Stan ever talk about cutlers that they knew that were older yet that they admired or that were kind of revered in the trade? And maybe that's just going back too far, but I'm always curious to know which heroes were the heroes of the heroes that we know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with Trevor, his hero was his uncle, who was a knife maker, and he was originally from Poland, but that was like Trevor's hero. It was brilliant. So what he did, he invented this knife, well, designed it, and it was like a two-blade Wharncliffe, but it had a Wharncliffe blade and a small like sheep foot blade. And everyone would say, oh, it'll not do well because it's not like traditional to what Sheffield were doing. But I think Wilkinson Sword took it on, and it was like one of the most popular knives that had ever been made in Sheffield.
Just goes to reestablish the fact that the sheep's foot blade is the most useful blade there is.
Yeah.
The guy was way ahead of his time.
He really was, yeah. Yeah. So that was like Trevor's, like his uncle was his hero. And with Stan, I mean, he always goes on to Ted Osborne, who trained him. He said he was obviously brilliant.
It's funny you mentioned Poland, because I know that, you know, most of us think of the Sheffield cutlers as being the best of the best, but there were certainly some phenomenal cutlers that came from France. And when you say Poland, also Bohemia, you know, before it was Czechoslovakia. And there were some phenomenal, nice, phenomenal cutlers who their skills and their crafts were as good as anybody else in the world. So It's sometimes easy to forget that there were other countries, other regions where there were some incredible talent.
Oh, definitely.
So, Stephen, you just had a knife in the Cutler's Hall, and I just saw that recently and saw the picture. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how they came about?
Yeah, well, it's this year is 400 years of the Cutler's Company in Sheffield, and the master cutler, Charles Turner, his company owned Wade and Butcher, which was a really old Sheffield company. So as to mark the 400 years, I made a replica of a Wade and Butcher pattern, which is on display in the Cutler's Company, in the Cutler's Hall in Sheffield.
Did you have a pattern book to work from on that one, or did you just take that out of a catalogue?
Out of an old picture. Picture from an old Wade and Butcher catalogue.
Okay.
Huh. Yeah. What it says on the catalogue, a lot of time it says knives to scale. So I drew it up from that.
Oh, very clever. Very cool.
Yeah.
How long was the handle? Was it 3.5?
About 3.5. About 3.5 inch. Yeah.
Okay.
It's got some nice, really small Victorian piece of Samba Stag.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It just fitted it right.
I don't remember seeing a close-up picture. I just remember seeing you holding the knife and then presenting it, and it looked like a beautiful piece. I'd love to see a closer view of it if possible.
Yeah, I'll get the pictures back out.
Okay. We might link something to the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Next thing is you're asking for the actual knife itself just to look at. Yeah.
So does that knife stay with the Cutler's Hall then?
Yeah, it's with the Cutler's Hall. Yeah, so it's on display and it'll just remain on display in the Cutler's Hall in Sheffield.
What other knives are on display there?
In the Cutler's Hall, they've got the Norfolk knife.
Yep.
They've got a massive display of Sheffield straight razors. And there's Joseph Rogers knives. There's old Worcester gnomes. They've got miniature Joseph Rogers knives. Just a combination of all the like Sheffield firms displaying all their work.
The miniatures. Have you made a miniature?
I have made a miniature, but I'm trying to get one make an even smaller one.
Like Greater Rice. I know Rogers got into that for a while.
They did, yeah.
Pioneered it. I don't know, as far as a mass consumer. Didn't they send them out? Didn't they used to send them?
Yeah, they used to send them out on a little, just to show what they could make.
Like a stationery or something, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, I've got a really Grainer Ice knife. And
yes, those are cool.
It's fantastic. And supposedly the story goes that a guy made it just as a bet for in a pub that I can make one smaller. And he was a Cutler at Rogers, and he made this little tiny little Grainer Ice knife.
Jeez.
And he won the bet.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. We've talked about it on the show a little bit in the past, but Neil and I've seen Grain of Rice. We've seen horseman's knives that are Grainer Ice with half stops. It's just nuts.
They're unbelievable.
The swedges on the blades.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Gosh. I mean, you'd have to have tiny files even. Files would have to be miniature.
to make
these things. The idea of miniature, you have posted something, and those listening, Stephen posts a lot of his work on Instagram, so you can see a lot of the stuff that we're talking about there. You've posted before miniatures. I don't know is there a company or a fella or a gal that makes miniatures in Sheffield, but you've done, I've seen it where it's water wheels and replicas of like old Cutlers.
Yeah, a friend of mine, he makes, it's called Sheffield Miniatures, and he makes, a pub that's in Sheffield or anywhere, he'll make like a scaled-down version so you can have one at home, in a picture frame. And he recreated a fantastic model of Shepherd's Wheel, which is an old 14th century grinding wheel up at Whiteley Woods, and he recreated it for the museum. And then after the exhibition, he had it at his house, and I'm friends with him. We were chatting away, and he says, make me a couple of knives and you can have it. So I've got it at home.
Oh, you have it?
Wow.
I have it, yeah.
Oh,
it's a brilliant, it's a working model.
It's awesome.
Huh. It's fantastic. And when I do an event at Kelham Island, the museum, I always take it to go on display down there at the Christmas market.
And do you hook up a garden hose to it?
Yeah, no, it could do with that. It just has the water wheel at the back and then all the little grinding wheels work off the little pulleys.
Yep.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. Oh.
Now that you've mentioned the Shepherd's Wheel, that do you ever volunteer time there?
I volunteer at Shepherd's Wheel. Yeah, for when visitors, because it's owned by Sheffield Museums.
Okay.
And occasionally at weekends, I'll put a day in and we'll volunteer just to show visitors around.
Interesting. And so Sheffield Museums, I'm assuming that with your knowledge of history and your dedication to cutlery there in Sheffield, that you're involved with the museums as well?
Yeah, I'm doing a talk in a couple of weeks at Kelham Island about making a Barlow knife, which will be available on YouTube after the 24th of April.
Oh, there we go. So that's something for our listeners to tune in for. Very interesting.
Did you know Ken Howley before he passed? Did you ever hang out with him?
Yeah, we're good friends with Ken. He was good friends with my dad, actually. Years ago, he used to have a tool shop in Sheffield on Button Lane, and my dad's workshop was just around the corner. And when years ago, somebody broke his window and pinched some tools out of his shop.
Oh.
And my dad found a fret saw on one of the little alleyways. So he took it back to his shop. And then ever since then, my dad and Ken Orley remain friends.
Hmm.
And obviously that's how my dad introduced me to Ken.
Wow. What a character.
He was. Yeah.
Have you had a chance to go through, I know Ken had an enormous pile of paperwork and catalogs and ephemera. Have you had a chance to sort through any of that or look through much of it?
I'd love to, but I haven't, no.
Okay.
I'd love to have a look through. I know the pattern books that I have, Ken always says that he wanted to borrow them to photograph them, to document them.
Yep.
So that's, I mean, in time, that's what I hope I'll be able to do with the Hawley Gallery.
I had seen that they had put a statue up of Stan down there.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to mark for all Little Mesters.
Oh, okay.
For everyone in the Hawley Gallery. It's a brilliant statue, which is in the Hawley Gallery.
I think more important than that legacy of Stan's is, I know that there's a brewery in town there that has some Stan Shaw.
Yeah, Little Mesters Brewery. Yeah.
Little Mesters Brewery.
Little Mesters Brewery, yeah.
And they have beers named after him?
It's just what it was, when the Stanshaw appeal to try and raise funds to make a lasting legacy, they released a beer, which was to raise the money to pay for a statue sort of thing, and to release this app that you can get on your phone so you can do a tour around Sheffield of all the places where Stan works or worked.
Oh, wow. That's very cool.
You use the word Little Mesters. Now I've heard the term messers and mesters. Are those interchangeable?
I don't know. I've only even known a Little Mester.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just that little. They're probably the Little Mesters to mark up like a collective of people. But I was used as like my uncle. He used to make scissors, and he owns like just a Little Mester.
Because I've seen the term without the T in there several times in different books and articles. And I always wondered, was that more of a dialect thing? Or was Messers just an abbreviation of Mesters? Was that way to shortcut it even more? But I was just curious.
Yeah, I think it's probably just the abbreviation of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Mesters was a Sheffield dialect, right?
Yeah.
For masters, they were a master of their own destiny, so to speak. They were in their own show. I've read all that, the Sheffield dialect. I have a copy of that somewhere. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah, you guys sure speak some weird English over in England.
We definitely do, yeah. Especially
just in Sheffield. Yeah.
We got our own language.
Where does Eglinton's hope to go now with what they're doing? Are they going to expand their cutlery brands? Are they going to offer more models? I'm kind of curious what's to look forward to in the future for us collectors.
Well, hopefully we'll be releasing like back catalogs, so like old patterns from days gone by, but with better materials and being made in the same methods, the same traditional manner as what Sheffield has always made knives. So obviously they do the Gunstock, the Barlow knife, and all being well, we'll be doing more knives, the old patterns. I mean, one knife I'm working on at the minute, I might make the prototype myself. We want to do the fisherman's knife, which was an old Iberson pattern, an 8-piece knife. So all being well, I'll make the prototype, and then if it gets approved at work, it should be released for other people to make.
Will that be an all metal handle knife like most of them were?
Yeah, this one should be all metal knife. Possibly, yep. We may do a few where it has a higher end one, where it has maybe jig bone or buffalo. But yeah, intentionally they will be all metal.
And how many brands does Eglinton own now? Obviously, Wollstonholme and Rogers.
It has William Rogers, John Clark's, and obviously their own, the Eglinton's.
Okay. Do you think they'll use all those brands, all those names on future knives?
Yeah. I mean, they still use William Rogers on the Commando knife. Yeah, Rogers, Worcester, Ohms. Maybe John Clark's on certain patterns, but William Rogers more so on their traditional like Commando knives.
So today, as we speak here in 2024, you know, in America, the cutlery that's the most popular is Great Eastern Cutlery. They use a lot of old techniques, etc., and modern ones, but they make great pocket knives of traditional patterns. And in Sheffield, it would be Eggington's. And you can still go, you can go to Eggington's website today and get yourself a nice Barlow, possibly made by Stephen or somebody trained by Stephen. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. Yes, it's someone I'm teaching them all, everyone there. So it'll be made by either myself or someone I'm teaching.
There we go. There's another avenue for you guys looking for knives. Check out Eggington, eggingtongroup.co.uk. You can find those knives and buy them there.
So in 50 years from now, there'll be young guys talking about Stephen Cocker.
That's right.
Yep.
That's right. Now, Stephen, what do you, I mean, you make knives like we've talked about from time to time on your own time and some amazing, beautiful pieces. Are these orders that you work on? You just make what you want? And how do you sell those?
Usually, I have a collector's base, which I like to buy my knives. I mean, I do get a lot of people asking me. And sometimes I have to say, well, to go to like Eggington's because sadly, I don't have enough hours in the day to make everything in my own right. But what I tend to like is I'll find an old pattern in a pattern book and I'll recreate that. And I might make a limited run of them. And usually as soon as I make them, people are asking for them and take them straight away.
What's been your personal favorite pattern to make so far?
I made an exhibition knife, which went on display in the museum, but sadly, it was stolen last year.
Oh, we know about that.
We heard about that, right.
Yeah, so I mean, that was, I spent ages making that and I made it just one of them things.
You know, it's hard to believe that someone would steal those knives because it's such a small community. They're all one-off knives. Anything that turns up anywhere, a number of people are going to see it, notice it, spot it. So to me, I think, what are you guys thinking? Where do you think you're going to sell these? I mean, unless there's some collector in a deep, dark cave somewhere that wants them for himself, you can't put them on any kind of public venue. They're going to get recognized. Has anything turned up since that thieving heist?
No, sadly nothing. They took them and it's just gone completely quiet. They've just disappeared completely.
And that knife they made off that you contributed, was that 14 piece?
Yeah, 14 piece.
With a buffalo horn? Was it buffalo?
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, buffalo.
You know, we were talking about horn before, and you do a fair amount of work in horn.
Yeah.
And I have my preferences, but what do you think makes good buffalo horn from a visual standpoint? What do you look for?
I like the colors in it. And I find lots
you
of times.
So you like the streaks of white and
yeah. I really go for the colorful pieces. I can spend hours going through and trying to match them up. And then when I've shaped it, I'll take it right down, and then polishing it up. I just keep going for it just to get a really nice bring the colors out of it. But I find a lot of time because I polish with pumice, so I mix like a paste of pumice, and it just brings like a shine out in the buffalo horn.
That's amazing. Yeah. The first time I ever worked with buffalo horn, I shoved it into the buffer and I feel like it was just for a second or two. And I took it out of the buffer and looked at it and there was barely any horn left. Yeah. I mean, it was gone.
Yeah.
Oh, rookie mistake.
Stephen, do you bias cut any of your horn like they did in the old days on some of the really great pieces?
Yeah, well, I buy... Normally, when I go around at like antique fairs, I'll try and find antlers, buffalo horn, and then I'll get it home and I'll cut it up myself. Same with pearl. Oh, wow. I'll buy shells and then I'll cut them so I can cut the size I want. And a lot of time, if I'm cutting like a pearl shell, I try and get the most colourful pieces. So I just cut it on my saw and, yeah, position it so I get two nice matching pieces.
Great. And we have to edit this out. We can't be letting these knife maker secrets out that we go around to.
Yeah, edit that.
What do you call it there? Garage sales and buy up old stuff?
Yeah.
So, Stephen, so you could buy a complete horn and then you're going to cut it and heat it and press it flat?
Yeah, I'll flatten it out. Yeah, I'll boil it. Yeah.
Oh, no kidding. Wow.
Yeah. Huh.
Do you ever use a torch on horn or just the hot water?
Just hot water. Yeah, and then trap it in with ice to squeeze it up.
Squeeze it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried pressing any designs or patterns into horn like some of the old cutlers did also?
I have got some like templates to do that, but I haven't done it myself. I have jigged bone many times myself, which I don't mind doing. But yeah, eventually I will obviously use some of these old press tools I've got to try and get the patterns like what they used to.
It's amazing how crisp and clear some of the horn was. And for people that don't know, you know, horn is a totally different material than bone or stag. Horn is basically hair fibers. But yeah. Horn is malleable and pressable, where stag and bone, for the most part, are not. But I've seen some really amazing patterns that were pressed into horn, and I go, holy criminies, that's just neat as heck. I'm not sure how they did it. I assume it was steamed, put into some kind of a press with an arbor, you know, something or other. I don't know how long it would have to be pressed for. I suppose just until it cooled.
Yeah.
But there are some neat patterns that exist in horn. Oh, there's some
fantastic patterns, yeah. Yeah.
You got to think that's from the French. I got to think their heritage is from the French. I don't know.
Probably.
What do you think, Neil?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. So when I'm working with stag, I put a torch to it and I bend it. Do you do any of that?
No, I just normally, with stag horn, I'll cut it and then boil it and then just like bend it. Do you want to get it really warm? I'll just stretch it out.
How long do you boil it for?
It varies. Just so it starts really getting a bit more flex, and then I'll just trap it in the leg vise. But sometimes, I mean, I'll grind it down, like maybe uneven, and then I'll boil it and then flatten it. So I'll really like stretch it out and then just leave it for a few days just to straighten up as best it can, and then go back on the flatbed to get it as flat as I can.
Right, right.
When you're boiling it, will you add some potatoes and vegetables and then have a nice soup later?
I would not eat that.
I mean,
no. it smells bad enough.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Gosh. What, you mentioned your leg vise.
Yeah.
Is that your primary vise you work from as a
yeah, leg vise? I always use a leg vise. Yeah.
And it's extremely uncommon in America to see a leg vise. What is the advantage to it over like a simple bench vise from a cutlery perspective?
I think in the Sheffield cutlers always used a leg vise, and I think it's just because you have the distance down, so you have space that you have your jaws, and then obviously the bits, obviously your bolts and everything, so you got space at the sides. Because years ago everything was shaped on vices,
yeah, and so you. It had 100 files, you needed space.
Space, yeah. So obviously, and then on a leg vise. I mean, I've got this, which is, I'll show you. If you can see that.
Oh, yeah. So that, you put in the actual vise.
Yeah,
so horizontal.
You put it in the vise. It's a side vise. So
yes.
You use your leg vise and then lock that in so you can file flat or shape your material. So it's like that.
That
that's
thing looks
like
old, Stephen.
Oh, it's very old, Pat. Yeah.
Yeah. That thing is cool. Boy, that's something you don't see every day.
No, I think that were originally, they were made at Mouse Hole Forge, which was in Sheffield. And it just like, it's an extension to your leg vise.
Is it stamped? Does it have markings on it?
So I have seen, Stan had one that had a little mouse on, but this one doesn't.
Okay.
But it exactly the same. So yeah.
Very cool. And what operations do you use that for the most?
I have used it for straightening. So when I've boiled the stag, I clamp it in that and then file it flat. or I've used it for rolling, just various tasks like that.
Okay.
Instead of using the like a flatbed sander.
That vise you just had shown, I have a couple examples, antique examples of miniature hand vises.
Yeah.
Which I've never seen modern versions of those, and but they must have been popular in the old days, where it was, you know, like I said, just a small clamp, and they called them a hand vise. So I'm assuming you're holding that, maybe holding a blade, holding something in it, and then you could work your file or some other tool around that. Do either one of you guys use what would be called a hand vise?
The only other thing I use is something like that, which just sits in your vise. So if you're doing file work on springs or on the backs of blades, it just enhances your vise a little bit.
Oh, interesting. Are those like pins in there to keep it?
Yeah, so that just, or? Yeah, them little pins just sit on the top of your leg vise and it just like locks in. Yeah, that's another like old Sheffield, I mean, it's only bits of steel that have been put together, but that's what they used to use. It's been hardened, so it
yeah,
has a bit of
yeah,
flex.
We have something similar that we use here would be called a file guide, but not nearly as versatile, I think, as that.
I do have other like inserts that go into a leg vise. Say like with linings, if it's similar to that, but it's at an handle. So when it's in your vise, you can file it at this correct handle, and you get like a nice chamfer all the way.
Very neat. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just so I'm clear, and the audience is clear, you guys are talking about a leg vise. Do you mean a vise that's basically between your knees that you're working, you're kind of wrapped around? Because what Mike says, a table vise, we all know what that is in America. It's your vise, it's mounted on a table. Is your leg vise down lower?
No, your leg vise, it just sits a bit higher, fastened to the bench, and it has like a long pole that comes down and fastens into like the floor for sturdiness.
So it gives it a very small footprint, but yet super sturdy.
Yeah, sturdy. And then you have all these tools that fit in it to do different tasks.
Right.
So neat. Now, since we're talking knife making, let's just talk knife making. I've got a big piece of road track that I do all my peening on. What do you peen on, Stephen? Do you have an old Stiddy?
I do, yeah.
Passed out?
Similar to that. Yeah, so that one, the one I use in my workshop is an old one that I was passed, like handed down from cutler to cutler, but obviously, being in Sheffield, in various old firms, see that there was, at one time, there was a lot more than what there is now. But yeah, I use a Stiddy like that.
Now, that Stiddy has a small horn on it, which I don't know if I've always seen that. What operation is that used for?
Usually for opening the knives up, so you can put like in between.
Oh, you can put the tang on there.
Yeah, put it in.
Hit it.
Putting bend on. This one's had some real use. It's really worn out.
It's cranked some blades, huh?
Yeah, it really has. But in Sheffield, they were all marked T-case. There were vices marked with that on, Stiddies marked with that on, and that must have been obviously the makers of these little anvils.
I'll be darned. So T-case, huh?
And
so for our listeners, because we're doing visual things right now, but Stephen's holding up basically a little cutler's piece of steel that's angled. It's about maybe 8 inches long or so, and it's got a small top to it, maybe by 3 by 2 inches. I don't know what that is in metric. I'm using imperial because I think the British still run America. I don't know. I've been told that. I've read it in books. But then what you would have in your workbench would be a small hole
that
would slide that into.
Yeah.
And that would support that.
Yeah. And that's it. Yeah, that hole, and you do all your work.
Is it dependent on the cutler? Or is it always in the same place? Or is it dependent if you're right-handed or left-handed? Or
no, usually it was just always in the same place and used it face on like that. So obviously the horn was pointing away from you and the little cutout was pointing towards you.
And that's for pounding pins through.
And
there's one hole in there. What's that hole used for?
Usually if it's just tapping the wire through. Sometimes they do have bigger holes in. Depends on, obviously, eventually over time when Sheffield started making more army knives, they'd have a wider hole to accommodate the wider wire. But it does have like a little peening hole in for riveting up.
Oh, so it's got a little depression in there.
Yeah.
A little dome depression. Man, that thing has seen some use.
Oh, it really has, yeah. It's amazing.
Could you make a knife without that? Are you prepared to make a knife without that?
I've been brought up using them, so I'd have to always go back to using that. I'd be lost without it.
Do you have multiple stitties, or you just work on that one stitty? And
I just work on one stitty. Just one. You just get used to one. I mean, I do have a few in my workshop, but obviously I just use the one, and it's just one I got used to.
Do you think that was made in Sheffield?
Yeah, made in Sheffield. Yeah, I believe, I tried to research this tea case. As far as I'm aware, they were a firm which is in the city centre, well, it was town centre, was tea case where they used to make them. I think it was Thomas Case.
Do you know what else they made? Did you find anything when you were looking?
Yeah, they used to make vices and other sorts of anvils and stuff like that, basically for the cutlery trade.
Yeah, I really need. I've always looked for one. I never have been able to find one of those. Or they're like in such unrecognizable, like there's hardly anything left to them. Yeah, the sides are all, yeah.
You know, Mike, you would think with all the Sheffield cutlers that came to America in the late 1800s, that they must have brought those with
them. Stuff got thrown away.
If that probably, sadly, probably.
I mean, if you had seen a stitty like that laying in a barn and you didn't know anything about cutlery, you would say, oh, there's a old piece of chunk of steel that's all beat to daylights.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or you would say, I have no idea what this is, but it's probably worth a dollar down at the scrapyard. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, one interesting thing I did find is I've got a little anvil. It's like a miniature version of a blade forger's anvil. Do you know, like the big, like,
oh, the big I've seen you post it. So it's a miniature. It's not the real, like,
it's not the real size of it. No, it's like a miniature one. And I've tried researching as if maybe it was used for making small blades or whether it was
jewelry.
I don't know. I've got it.
When you say that, I think two things. I think either jewelry or I think a salesman's sample.
Yeah.
My mom was a big antique collector and had quite a few salesman's samples, which people always assumed were children's items, and they weren't. They were for a guy to take around and show potential customers and clients, hey, this is what we make, and oh, that's neat. Yeah, I'll take one.
Yeah, because in a way, it was more easy. It's obviously more easy to carry this little anvil.
Correct.
Does it have all the markings on it? And they used to shape the tangs on there. Yeah. Put the nail nicks in.
Yeah, so that's it. So it's like a miniature to the like a proper blade forger's anvil. So it's got the plates. Obviously, the pieces on where you'd forge your blade, where you'd break the blade off, and it's even got that little bit on what would have been used for nail nicking. Fascinating little item.
That is really neat.
And it's an exact, obviously, miniature replica of the blade forger's anvil.
Boy, I would certainly guess salesman sample would be my first thought. Mike's thinking, boy, would I like to have that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
No, I've never really seen one before.
I'd like to have the real thing and try to figure out how to like forge a blade on it. You know, that would be, I mean, we still have that one. I know there's at least one video from Ken Hawley that has the penknife maker using one. Like forging that blade on that anvil.
Huh. Yeah. Wow.
Fascinating. Just the amount of blades. I mean, those guys are different because that's all they did. They didn't have to make a whole knife, but just the amount of art and just, I don't know, the tacitness of the whole process.
Yeah.
That is gone. It's gone.
Yeah.
It will never come back.
No, there used to be a guy called Albert Craven who was on that video.
Yes. That's the video. Yes.
Yeah. He was actually a friend of my dad's. And he, he could forge, it was just one after the other. It was just, and each one, I mean, I've got some of his blades, and you could line them all up and each one perfect.
Looks like it came off a CNC machine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Each one as good as the one before.
Oh, all right. Let's keep talking knife making for a minute before I get too nostalgic and Neil starts shedding tears over there. Yeah. you still do a lot of operations the way they did them in the 1800s, maybe earlier, who knows? I know I've made some comments to you in the past about your fly presses.
Yeah.
Which are pretty unusual in America to see somebody use a fly press. maybe a kick press or a big arbor press, but not a fly press. And you still stamp out your bolsters, no?
Yeah, yeah.
So you have like old molds for stamping.
Yeah, for the old dies for doing different patterns of bolsters.
Very fascinating.
It's a lot of the stuff I've managed to like save is stuff I've been passed on because the old cutler was like retiring and leaving, or I've saved stuff when I knew it was going to be thrown out for scrap, and I've like preserved it, managed to protect it. Otherwise, I've seen stuff be scrapped in Sheffield, and it's heartbreaking the amount of stuff that I have seen. So I've tried to save as much as I can.
Right, good for you. How is the fly press different than an arbor press?
The fly press, it's just your normal. I mean, I've got in my workshop, I've got two big, one medium, one big fly press, and they're just your large press with the ball on top. That came from John Watts.
Oh, no kidding!
Yeah, yeah, but it's funny because it's an open back fly press, which is like unusual because usually like the solid backs, this one's an open back one, and then I've got a full back one. But also I do, in my workshop, I've got an old Sheffield press, which is your press with a big flywheel at the back. And they were designed for the cutlery trade, for blanking cutlery out or cutting bolsters.
Oh, so it has a motor on it.
They used to work off a big line shaft.
Yeah, line shaft. Of course.
Initially from a motor, yeah.
And so do you punch blades out or do you have them cut? How does that work?
I cut them out myself, just either hacksaw them out or I have forged blades, depending on what knife I'm making.
Oh, really? So you have forged some of your own blades?
So, some of them, yeah. The smaller, for certain patterns, I've forged my own blades out. There used to be this guy who I used to spend hours watching and forging blades, and he was brilliant. And as a child, I thought I always wanted to have a go doing it. So I obviously just choose to practice.
Oh, yeah. Who doesn't want to swing a hammer around?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
I mean, I've got a picture of myself. I must have been about, 9-year-old, 10-year-old, having to go forging blades out. And it's just something that's always stuck with me. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, I can see you still doing it time to time, especially when that supervisor at Eggington's is running roughshod over you. I'll go forge some blades.
Yeah.
Wow. So what? All right. We talked fly presses and stitties, and okay. Well, we have to talk about the parser. How do you inlay shields today? Do you still use a parser?
I still use I brought one. Oh yeah. So I still use a two-legged parser.
Two-legged parser.
I've got a lot of the old templates, which are just your steel templates with your shape cut out. And then I have a breastplate, which I fit on, a bow, which wraps around the
bobbin there, yeah.
Yeah, and then revolve it up and down, and it just cuts the shape of the template out, which is, if I've got one, I don't think I've got one in here, but yeah, it's just, so depending on what shape you want, it just cuts, I have it there. So that's one I've got, just to, an intricate shape.
Yeah, little steel template with the opening of whatever shape of shield you're putting in. And I think a lot of knife makers here in America are familiar with that. A lot of them still use those, except they use them with like a drill press or some sort of bit running. Because we don't, you can't go down to the local store and get a two-legged parser anymore. No. On that parser, I've always had a question.
Yep.
I've always thought about making my own because I know how fast they are to use, that there's nothing faster than a parser. Do you ever have to touch up the tips that do the cutting?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So with them tips, sometimes they'll break or they might need sharpening. So I just recut them and sharpen them up.
Okay. So that parser that you're holding up right now, which I'm guessing is like maybe 10 inches long or so, the actual two pieces, and with the bobbin, maybe 14 inches. It was probably longer than that originally.
Yeah, originally, yeah. And then just over time, it's just obviously shrunk down. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I've got loads of them. For different templates, sometimes I'll have larger cutters, shorter cutters, wider cutters, because obviously So, like, if I'm inlaying a shield on a Bowie knife, I want larger cutters to clear more material quickly than smaller cutters.
Or something with rounded corners, or maybe like an oval or rounded bar or something where you don't need to get into nooks and crannies.
Yeah, to clear all the material away.
Very fast. How fast can you cut in a shield pocket with that?
I could probably have it done under a minute.
Oh. That's fantastic. You have the old molds to press your shields?
I've got the templates to cut my own shields. And then just tap them in, drill them, pin them in.
That would be fun to have. And I've seen those old cutlers. I've seen the videos where they pinch it against the mark side of the handle and stick it in their vise, and
it's
almost a seamless operation, and like all in 1 second, they just eyeball it and put it in there. Of course, I've got many knives from the 1800s where it's very obvious they eyeballed the placement of that shield.
Yeah.
Do you have any old files that you're using that maybe Stan or somebody else would have had? I'm always curious what the life of a file is with you guys.
Yeah, I've got some really old files.
Still cut.
Still cut as perfect as obviously the day they were made. I've got some interesting ones, and they were like, they're cut into, I think somebody's like, over time, someone's redeveloped them, and it's a flat file, but they've like got score marks in. So if you have a bolster and you want to put, say, like four lines on, you can use these files and thread a bolster, and you just cut it over, and it just threads them perfectly.
Wow.
Yeah,
I might cut this part out. I'm going to keep that piece of information for myself.
I'll get my files out. I'll send you a picture of them. But how they cut, they're brilliant. So you can just hold the knife and just run it over, and he just cuts the lines beautifully in.
You know, I don't think people appreciate though how much skill it takes to do good filing. I mean, I've grown up with hand tools. I've grown up in the trades, and I've used a file my whole life, but. One day, many years ago, I was over at a friend's house who was a machinist and a jeweler, both. He did both. And to watch him use a file, and for me to try to mimic that, it was like, holy cow, you are good. You are really good with that file. I thought I was decent. He blew me away with his technique and the way he could cut an even line going around a curve or something. And I thought, that is years of practice with a file. Yeah. That's something that goes... That was a skill. And you don't think of that. You think of a file as just, hey, you're shaving off some metal. No, there's a real art to using a file.
Definitely. Yeah.
And do you still do use files a lot as far as, like, I know the old timers would have a hardened pattern and they would file the liners out?
Yeah, a lot of my personal knives, what I make, because I'm like wanting to keep them as original as possible, I'll file every piece out. Like with shaping on certain knives, if I spoke to the who was having it, I'll not use belts. So I want to shape it on wheels, shape it by files, and do everything traditionally.
But you do use more of the modern methods, something, you know, belt grinders and that type of thing as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I use belts as well. It's just on certain knives for certain people who want something like really back to how it was done. I'll just use different wheels dressed with different emery, different grates to do the shaping.
You do have a water wheel, right? Do you grind some blades on water?
Yeah, I do
wheels?
Hand grind it. Yeah, that's at Eggington's out. Yeah, still do hand grinding
on a water wheel. How big is that stone? What's a diameter?
It depends what I'm doing. So they're all like, we have different sizes for like different sort, different size blades that run in the water. Yeah, so it's just. Depends on what we're grinding.
And do you prefer that method over belts, or are you ambivalent to it?
Sometimes I like to use the grindstone because I think I get like real like sharp corners, and I do enjoy the history behind it and obviously using stones. But on for some quicker work, I will use belts depending on what I fancy doing on that. But yeah, I do like to use the grindstone. There's just something about it.
I guess back to my question I had almost started to ask was, you mentioned emery.
Yeah.
And that got me to thinking, you probably do have some old wooden wheels or something to polish up your blades. You know, for a lot of us knife makers out there. We put satin finishes on with just our fingers and sandpaper, and it's a tedious process. Or we work up our belt progression, and but we don't polish the way the old timers do. But you still do, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Use some of those techniques.
Yeah, I still use wooden wheels with the leather on, the bull's neck leather, dressed with different grits, different emeries, and taken from your grind all the way down to your fine finish.
Do you make those emeries yourself, or do you buy them?
We can buy them. They still supply them locally. Then they just roll the wheel. Well, we put glue on and then roll it on the wheel.
Oh, that's how you get that on there, with glue. And you said bull's neck leather?
Yeah, that's what the leather is, yeah.
I've read about that, and it's amazing to think that you're doing all these different final grades. And I know they used to talk about the black polish, the black mirror finish on a blade, which you can see if you're fortunate enough to see an authentic, really high quality old Sheffield piece, and you go, my God, this finish is like nothing I've ever seen before. And it is. It's just a series of finer and finer and finer. And you think about wood and leather. How can you possibly do anything to steel with wood and leather? But you can. It puts on that final incredible finish.
And just to think they had mostly figured all this out in the 1700s, early 1800s.
Yeah.
This had all been worked out.
Only a couple hundred years ago.
No electrics. No lights overhead.
No.
None of that. Boy, if I don't have a spotlight right on it at all times, whatever I'm doing, I might as well shut it down.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. That's so neat that you're still using a lot of those techniques. And I know a lot of those techniques are probably faster, but it's a art that's mostly lost. Of course, you can't buy half the stuff you have anymore, Stephen, but just the technique is, well, I hope you keep at it.
I enjoy doing it. So keep going.
I think it's great too that you're training that new group of cutlers at Eggington's too, because you're helping to keep this alive. So by you passing your knowledge to other guys, other women, other craftsmen, I think that's a noble thing in itself. That's fantastic.
So I never want it to just finish. I always want it to carry on, especially with Sheffield, with the history of it. I'd rather people learn and for future generations.
Yeah.
I hope today's modern culture doesn't continue to work against you, but it is amazing that the modern world came out of Sheffield, everything we have today. All right. Well, let's wrap this one. I feel like this will be episode one of Stephen Cochran. Stephen, we thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We hope we can have you back on. I'm sure our listeners are going to demand more, and we'll probably get hate mail for not asking all the right questions, but it was a fascinating conversation, and we're so fortunate to have some time with you and to see some of your work, and people can see you out there on Instagram, right?
Yeah.
If they put in Stephen Cocker or something or other, I can't remember your whole...
Yes, Stephen Cocker, Sheffield Knives.
Sheffield Knives, and that's probably the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah. They go on there.
Yeah, if some billionaire wants to commission a piece done or something of that nature.
Yeah, get in touch with me.
And you can see a lot of Stephen's handiwork over at Eggington's website we mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
So give them a quick look. And that was great to have you. And we appreciate all the listeners here. And we'll catch you on the next episode.